Tonight I'm going to show you the advances Western industries has made in commercial sciences. Television is the most powerful selling medium in the history of mankind. Tonight, we'll show you some of these new television commercials generated by our computer on the 19th floor.
Television can control public opinion more effectively than armies or secret police because television is entirely voluntary. The American government forces our children to attend school, but nobody forces them to watch TV. Americans of all ages submit to television. Television is the American ideal. Persuasion without coercion. Nobody makes us watch.
Who could have predicted that a free people would voluntarily spend one-fifth of their lives sitting in front of a box with pictures? 15 years sitting in prison is punishment. For 15 years sitting in front of a television set is entertainment. And the average American now spends more than 1.5 years of his life just watching television commercials. 50 minutes every day of his life. Watching commercials. Now that's power.
And yet the commercials have been as crude as snake oil pitches till now. Now, Western Industries has scientific commercials. Commercials combining computer-generated actors in real settings in a highly effective way, the way we future it. So without further ado, Western Industries is proud to present its latest visual development.
I saw it on Linden Street.
Well, hello. And welcome to I Saw It on Linden Street, the show dedicated to the joy of finding an appreciation in cult films, exploitation oddities, beloved classics, and all points in between. I'm your host, Chris Roberts, inviting you to join us here at the Linden Street Cinema Experience Theater as we once again dig up a fun cinematic relic from the past. Now, if you're new to the show, first, thank you so much for joining us. This isn't your standard film review. Rather, it's sort of a synopsis of the film that we feel deserves to have another inspection, with some background thrown in on the actors, information on the director, and hey, if I'm doing my job, perhaps you'll get a half-amusing story out of me. Now, fair be warned, while we don't cover all aspects of the plot, we do discuss endings and spoilers. So, if you'd like to be surprised, please give the film a viewing before you listen to us. If you like us, and hey, I would hope that you do, please recommend this podcast to a friend, give us a favorable review. Once again, you find me apologizing. I'm showing up a day late, and in this case, more than a month late, and a dollar short. The reasons? Well, several. Work, definitely work. The holidays, getting sick, and like half of the people in the Midwest, just trying to dodge all of the various types of upper respiratory, colds, COVID, RSV, flu that's flying around over here. That all said, though, it's not a really good excuse, but I apologize. But we're going to close this crazy year out with sort of semi-topical techno fare. We're going to be screening Michael Crichton's 1981 thriller, Looker. Join us! Shockingly, this month's authoring is another film that I caught when I was in college, a recommendation made to me by the great Xerxes himself. I know, for those of you who listen on the semi-regular, the room must be spinning right now. We were at work, standing around wasting time talking movies as we were wont to do, and somehow we got on the subject of the actor Albert Finney, and we were commenting on some of his good stuff, you know, like Miller's Crossing. Did I say good? I'm sorry, I mean amazing. And we were comparing that to some of his trashy but still fun stuff, like Wolfen. And that's when Xerxes brought up this week's film, and I found myself sent down a dark path. What do you mean you haven't seen Looker? Holy shit, you're gonna lose your mind. It's a Michael Crichton PG stroke fest of epic proportions with Albert Finney, Susan Day, and James Coburn. Get your coat. coat. You're renting it tonight. Buoyed by that level of enthusiasm, and quite frankly happy to be leaving work early to go rent a movie. See, it pays to talk shop with the boss. We end up walking down to the local mom-and-pop video store, and for the princely sum of $1, I know, I miss it, I was able to rent Looker, and, making for a really strange double feature, Frank Hettenlotter's Brain Damage. But that's going to have to be a story for another day. I went back to my dorm room, I grabbed myself some greasy cafeteria food, and I had a little movie marathon. And damned if he wasn't right, this was right up my alley. And honestly, I have to say too, I saw Looker at the absolute right age. I caught it when I was in college, because this is one of those golden pre-1984 PG offerings that, oddly enough, offers up ample nudity. And I can tell you right now, if young Chris had happened upon this, the concept alone of a naked Laurie Partridge, or Grace Van Owen if you are a certain age and caught L.A. Law, being in this film would have melted my brain. I would later end up ripping a copy from a VHS that I rented and then burned it to DVD and started sharing this movie, first with a cousin who fell in love with it, strangeness and all, and then it just became this weird, fun one-off film that I would pass around with other people who would claim to either A, like strange stuff, or B, would tell me they were big Michael Crichton fans. Creepy personal information aside, if we're going to talk about Looker, I think we should pause first and address just why it should matter to any of us right now. And naturally, this leads us to the current, or at least the now sort of winding down, SAG-AFTRA negotiations. So, oddly enough, at least our version of topical, because now we're a good month and a half, 2 months late, I'm going to just start to explain that our latest selection here at the LSCE is, well, pertinent. How, you may ask? Well, if you've been living under a rock for about the past 6 months or so, you may not have noticed how the SAG-AFTRA actors have been taking to the streets and refusing to shill for their studio overlords, all over demands for better contracts, better pay, and how their future craft will be affected by the use of AI. Sure, I know, you're all like me, some sort of commie pinko bleeding heart who just loves the spectacle of entertainment, but acknowledges that you want to see people earn a fair wage. Damn the man, grab a sign, join the picket line. But, really, we're at a real turning point in the entertainment labor history, because, for the first time, one of the stickiest points in negotiations for contracts was hinging on the use of artificial intelligence, and its unprecedented potential that would, well, essentially render actors and actresses that we know and love useless in the long term. How? Well, one would just have to have a computer program to sample patterns of their speech, map their facial expressions, and of course, graph their visage over the frame of a similar actor body type of roughly the same build, and all of a sudden, you have something that is really an impressive feat. Like, oh, I don't know, what's a recent example? Let's say bringing back the amazing Peter Cushing, a man who's been dead since 1994, and suddenly he's showing up on the big screen to play the character of Grand Moff Tarkin in a 2016 Star Wars prequel, Rogue One, just a scant 22 years after his death? And while that was really cool, that can take on somewhat of a sinister connotation. Is it impressive? Oh, absolutely. Did it look amazing? Yeah. And surely in the years since and in the years to come, the AI is only going to get smoother, cleaner, and become nigh indecipherable from seeing a digitally shot scene. And therein lies the problem. Where does it stop? To what end does a person actually own and maintain their own voice, likeness, essence? Now, healthy, rational people will pause, take in the gravity of the situation, while others of you might just look up from your bag of cheese doodles and wonder, why aren't we getting another season of Abbott Elementary delivered this fall? But seriously, at least as of we speak when this was being recorded, the studios had issued what they were terming their last best offer, how melodramatic, to the members of the SAG-AFTRA Guild, and they would give them some sort of things that they wanted. They would give them increase in pay, and then they would go back and forth on exchanging over who owned the digital likenesses of the actor or actress in perpetuity. Because studios would like to be able to insert them into projects or use them for advertising in a way that a star may be morally opposed to. And what's worse, the deal as it was written before for the studios, they could do that without having to pay royalties to various actors and actresses' estates. So your relatives don't even get to have a say in how their loved ones are used. Now keep in mind, we've really come a long way since that 1997 commercial where it featured Fred Astaire dancing on the ceiling with a Dirt Devil vacuum. We have cutting-edge AI now, so there could be expressions, talking, emoting, a whole performance available to us. Just think of all the content and good ideas this could possibly generate. Finally, you're going to be able to see Norman Fell wax poetic about the full sense of security he has as the new spokesperson for Snug brand anal beads. Or you could flip on the TV on a Sunday afternoon and you could see good old Donna Reed showing up with John Madden in the locker room right before the big game to share her problems with foot fungus too. And that's when they promote tough actin-tin actin. Clearly, we are being robbed as a generation of self-absorbed, pop culture-obsessed consumers. But again, I can hear you ask, Chris, that's great and you're being ridiculous. Why are you talking about contract negotiations? Well, for this episode's offering, we are talking about a film thriller that had the prescience to wonder what would actually happen if such AI technology had existed at our fingertips over 42 years ago. Presented and penned by director none other than the late prophetic conspiracy wingnut himself, Michael Crichton. Now, we've talked about Crichton before when we covered his amazingly fun 1973 classic Westworld back in the day. Seriously, go back, check that one out, it's fun. The man was, I'll just say complex. He had some rather interesting views about the world, but we can't deny he created some really long-lasting content. And now that leads you to ask, well, where did this mess come from? Well, in the late 1970s, we saw Crichton coming in hot off of two very successful director jobs. He had helmed the big screen adaptation of Robin Cook's Coma in 1977 with Michael Douglas and Genevieve Bugeaud, and then he'd followed that up with a successful translation of his own novel, The Great Train Robbery, in 1978 with Sean Connery and Donald Sutherland. Crichton then thought his next project would be to adapt his own novel, The Eaters of the Dead, to the big screen. But that would end up taking more than two decades before his Viking adventure would hit cinemas, and that would eventually be released as 1999's The 13th Warrior. Crichton then moved to pitching a jungle adventure that he had concocted in his head that was originally meant to be his take on an Alan Quatermain adventure. But you know, with killer gorillas. And he had done that as a full pitch to 20th Century Fox, who paid him outright for the screenplay, novel, and gave him a director's fee. All for a story that was not yet written. Crichton took the fee and eventually worked the story into what would become his 1980 novel, Congo. But when it came time to talk screenplay and directing, he found himself to have a bit of a problem. Well, he did get the interest of Sean Connery to work with him again. He would have played the big game hunter Monroe, who takes a chartered company party on this great jungle adventure. But actually, the real issue came from the author's own subject matter, because according to Crichton, hey, gorillas are an endangered species, and shockingly, you can't get gorillas to act on camera. 20th Century Fox head at the time, Sherry Lansing, informed Crichton that they would be ending pre-production on Congo, and they would just simply put the project into what they call turnaround, which is a really fancy way of saying, we own it, and we're purposely not going to make it. Go have a nice life. It would take another 15 years before director Frank Marshall would come along, and with the backing of Paramount Studios, he would bring Congo to the big screen. Free now from any sort of simian-related obligations, Crichton moved on to a more modern concept, returning to an idea that he had been entertaining a few years prior, starting with the thought that people in Hollywood were seeking bodily perfection through new techniques in plastic surgery. And he wondered how the coupling of that with how current advertising technology was being utilized, how that could be used for maybe a sinister purpose. Back in the day, he'd even made some inquiries just about what would it take to have a company use computers to create what would essentially be copies or parodies of current existing commercials, without seeming like some kind of nut. He learned that the process was actually already being done, and the use of computer rendering at the time was called tomography. It's where multiple 2D scans of an object basically are being done by various ways. Back in the day, it was mainly x-rays, and you would take a photo over and over again and then compile those photos in your computer program to assemble those 2D images, and then it would render a full 3D model by taking all those chunks and putting them together. Now, as Crichton tells it, the title, at least the concept of the title, Looker, just popped into his head one day, and he ran with it. And he started outlining a story about television and subliminal messaging control, and the use of this scary new digitization. Post-Congo, Crichton was on the outs with Fox, so he started peddling this concept around town, and wound up at the Ladd Company, which was still back in the day trying to prove itself, having made only at that time about 4 pictures. Two of which, though, were critical and commercial successes, Chariots of Fire and Body Heat. The other one was Bette Midler's Divine Madness concert film, and then Peter Hyams' awesome Sean Connery Outland, which, seriously, is going to have to be a future episode one day, and at least that became a cult classic. Alan Ladd Jr., who was running the company, really liked Crichton's concept, and he agreed to hire him to write and direct the screenplay for a decent budget of about $8 million. Now, they just needed to find some actors and deal with some rather ironic holdups. Albert Finney was cast as the lead, Dr. Larry Roberts, reluctant Beverly Hills surgeon who finds himself framed for the murders of several patients. Finney was coming in on a hot streak of his own, working steady for almost a decade, and Looker would actually prove to be the third film that he had done in a row in 1981 after John Quested's thriller Loophole and the aforementioned Wolfen. Susan Day was cast, still trying to shake her Laurie Partridge persona off, here as Sydney Fairmont, the smart and funny model actress who teams up with Dr. Roberts to try to help clear his name and prevent her own murder. Day would increasingly worry about the film as production rolled on, not quite comprehending the impact her full-body nudity would have when the film would later show up on home video releases and would sometimes haunt her. James Coburn was on board to play the villain. Coburn was at the time experiencing a sort of cooling for his career, finding himself relegated to playing villains or only having supporting roles, such as with the film High Risk that came out this same year. Coburn would also go on to be a rather vocal critic about how this movie turned out, but he was still able to convey his signature detached malevolence here as our film's main villain. Add in Dorian Harewood, whose credits at the time included the 1978 submarine thriller Grey Lady Down and 1979's Roots, The Next Generation. He shows up to play the inquisitive detective Lieutenant Masters, who's checking up on the murders. But for a movie about beauty, we need some proverbial skin in the game. And when you have a movie that features this many models in search of perfection, that's where you get the inclusion of Terry Wells, who was 1981's Playboy Playmate of the Year and was also dating Crichton at the time, as well as 1977's Playboy Playmate Ashley Cox and the former Miss Florida herself, Catherine Parks. Lee Taylor Young, another beauty of Soylent Green and Jagged Edge fame shows up here to play our cold and cunning CEO. And then we can throw in a pre-Weekend at Bernie's Terry Kaiser, and former NFL lineman Tim Rossovich, character actor Daryl Hickman, and even a don't blink or you will miss it, young Vanna White, showing up here in the background as one of the Reston models at the evening gala. So I think it's safe to say we do have a decent cast here. Initial filming was supposed to start on location in Los Angeles in August of 1980, but wouldn't you know it, they had a SAG strike in 1980 that started in July, which ended up scrapping those plans and pushing production to be delayed out until the strike ended in late October. The shooting started and then just continued to experience issues, so it didn't wrap until January of 81. And during this time, the film ended up going over schedule and over budget, both with what they could shoot and with the CGI effects. About those, it was notable, this is the first time you actually had a full body scan that was rendered for a film, and it was very costly, and it ended up spiking that final cost of $8 million to $12 million when all was said and done. And unfortunately, as we will see later in the breakdown, we ended up with too many cooks in the kitchen on post-production. You see, Crichton had written this film, yes, as a thriller, but also as social satire, and it had a lot of comedy in it, creating these broad, silly caricatures that our characters would find themselves in a thriller but still cracking jokes about it, all done with a certain kind of tongue-in-cheek. But that's where he parted ways with Alan Ladd Jr., who wanted a straight thriller. He wanted this to be an exciting movie for adults, hard-hitting. Ladd had final cut on the movie, and when it was finished, he brought it back to the company and let his editors take multiple swipes at air quotes fixing the film to deliver the final product we got today, removing much of the humor that Crichton had already put into the film, but really not able to do a ton with the pacing or punching the actual story up to increase the thriller aspect. This, of course, would lead to problems. But, folks, you've been ever so patient in listening to me gas on and flap my gums. How's about I shut up and we get to that trailer? What do you say?
I want it. You probably think I'm beautiful, Dr. Roberts, but I'm not.
I want it.
My nose is 0.2 millimeters too narrow, and my cheekbones are 0.4 millimeters too high.
I want it, too.
And your television commercials, they want a certain look.
Hi, I'm Cindy. I'm the perfect female type. Hi, I'm Cindy. I'm the perfect female type.
You don't know what's going on. This is more than commercials. They're killing all the girls that are perfect.
I did surgery on several girls a few months back. There have been some suicides.
What have you got me mixed up in? I have a right to know if somebody's trying to kill me.
Don't look at the screen.
If looks could kill, look her.
We open in the office of renowned Beverly Hills plastic surgeon Dr. Larry Roberts, as played by Albert Finney, as he's consulting with model and actress Lisa Convey, as played by Terry Wells. A woman who has brought with her a list of changes she would like made to her body and face down to the millimeter, all claimed to be needed for work purposes.
You probably think I'm beautiful, Dr. Roberts, but I'm not. I have lots of defects to fix. I have a list right here. My nose is 0.2 millimeters too narrow, and my cheekbones are 0.4 millimeters too high. And my chin has a little 0.1 bump here. And my areolar distance is 5 millimeters, and I have a mole here on my ribs, so I need plastic surgery. Is something wrong, Dr. Roberts?
It's just that you're very beautiful, Lisa, and I can't imagine why you'd want to change what God has given me.
It's for work. I do television commercials. They want a certain look.
These changes are tiny, Lisa. Nobody would notice the difference.
Dr. Roberts, you did my friends Tina and Cindy and Susan, and everybody says you're the best plastic surgeon in Beverly Hills.
Would you excuse me for a minute? I'd like you to see my partner.
Larry ends up consulting with his partner, Dr. Jim Belfield, as played by Daryl Hickman, and while both men agree that Lisa does not really need any of the procedures she's demanding, Belfield points out that if Roberts doesn't do the surgery, someone far less competent certainly will. Acknowledging that to be true, Dr. Roberts ends up performing the surgical changes at Lisa's request, and through time-lapse montage we see the surgery, Lisa healing, and then we cut to her preparing for a date with her boyfriend, admiring herself in the mirror, only to seemingly be startled by an abrupt flash that causes her to appear to go into a trance and lose time. This happens several times around her apartment until it's revealed that an unknown man is stalking her through her own home. As if she's being controlled by some sort of unknown force, Lisa finds herself inexplicably wrapped up in her own curtains and then seems to fall from her balcony as a shadowy figure looks on and then leaves a pen and a button from Dr. Roberts behind in Lisa's apartment. Dr. Roberts goes to work the next day and meets with Cindy Fairmont, as played by Susan Day, an actress and a model who is following up with him post-surgery. Cindy casually flirts with Larry, asking him if he has dinner plans, but Larry begs off. He's going to a fundraising event at a pediatric burn unit. Cindy comments that Dr. Roberts has now successfully made her and 3 of her friends perfect with his medical skills. His consultation is interrupted with the arrival of Lieutenant Masters, as played by Dorian Harewood, of the LAPD, who would like to ask him just a few questions about his former patients, revealing to him that Susan Wilson and Lisa Convey are now dead. When Larry goes to pull his medical files on the 2 women, he discovers that they are also missing, leading Lieutenant Masters to begin to hint that he believes Dr. Roberts is somehow behind these murders. Patient Tina Cassidy, as played by Catherine Witt, stops by Dr. Roberts' office in that same afternoon, very distraught and desperately requesting that Dr. Roberts reverse the changes that he made to her, claiming that now that she's been made perfect, she too is going to be killed. She informs Larry that she plans on skipping town and staying with family in Chicago until she'll find a doctor there who could fix her. As Roberts tries to comfort her, she ends up panicking further when a long-distance call comes in for her, noting that nobody should know that she's here, and that the police are in on this too, before running out. Tina leaves behind her purse, and Larry notes that she has a printout from some company called Digital Matrix Incorporated. Larry ends up leaving work that evening and travels to Tina's apartment to return her purse to her. But as he pulls up to the building, he witnesses a flash from above and then watches in horror as Tina comes screaming down, her body striking a parked car before bouncing to the concrete. He then sees a hulking, mustached man staring down at him from her balcony, but he can't find him when he runs up and enters Tina's apartment. He details what happened to Lieutenant Masters, who hates his story, but with witnesses there, believes him. Knowing that Cindy is now the last of the 4 women alive who has been worked on for what appears to be a very specific client, Larry invites her to join him at a fundraiser thrown by media billionaire John Reston, as played by James Coburn, sparking her interest in future work and allowing him to keep an eye on her. At the party, they meet Jennifer Long, as played by Lee Taylor Young, the head of Digital Matrix Incorporated, and they get to learn about just what exactly they're doing in the world, and it's a lot. But the CEOs also turn the tables and begin to grill Roberts as well.
So what exactly does Reston Industries do?
We're a $6 billion conglomerate, 37 countries around the world. We're diversified into fast foods, leisurewear, pharmaceuticals. We do high technology, perceptual devices, military head-up displays, pinball machines, television commercials. But I understand you have something to do with commercials, too.
Me?
Well, yes, it was on the news tonight, something about girls who died after having plastic surgery. It was a police report.
Well, it was just a routine inquiry. I didn't realize my name would be mentioned.
Well, I hope it doesn't cause you any trouble.
What was the inquiry about, Dr. Roberts?
It's all a coincidence, really. I did surgery on several girls a few months back, commercial actresses, and there've been some suicides.
How awful.
Well, unstable young actresses are trying to make some fast money in commercials. Why didn't? Tougher than they thought, that's all.
Well, the police can't think that you had anything to do with it.
Oh, no, it's nothing like that.
Well, that's good. We couldn't get involved in anything awkward.
No, actually, the girls are all linked with some company called Digital Matrix.
Digital Matrix? Well, that sounds rather sinister, doesn't it, Jennifer? See, Jennifer runs Digital Matrix.
Really?
Yes, Digital Matrix does basic research for Western Industries.
Well, it's true that DMI measured some girls for possible surgery. We were conducting an experiment on a new visual technology, but we never went forward with it. I mean, are you sure that these are the same girls?
I think so.
Digital Matrix does mostly theoretical research.
I can't believe it. How many girls have died?
Three.
It must be a coincidence.
Well, that's what it sounds like to me. Coincidence.
At the party, Cindy has a bit too much to drink and is a little upset when Larry takes her back to his place to stay the night, but he doesn't make any moves on her. He sets her up instead in the guest bedroom. He makes her breakfast the next morning and offers to take her to work on the commercial that she's shooting at the beach for Hawaiian Tropic Suntan Oil. Larry is actually quite interested in the DMI van that is on site monitoring the shoot, until they close the doors in his face. Cindy is informed, however, that they will need to finish the commercial using some CGI effects, and the director requests her to go visit Digital Matrix Incorporated headquarters to have her full body scanned for her measurements. Larry ends up accompanying her to keep an eye on things, and while Cindy is getting the body scan done, Jennifer Long meets him in the lobby and gives him a tour of the facility, showing him some of their research.
Digital Matrix is a research and testing facility. This building was opened last year to do various kinds of visual research under contract to other companies in the Reston Group. I can give you a good example of what we do here. This is where we do visual research. And these subjects are looking at ordinary commercials that we always use for research. We record their pupillary scans. Today we're testing only women, but would you like to see what it's like?
Sure. This is worse than the dentist.
But it doesn't hurt. I'll show you a stimulus. You just relax and watch.
It's been 6 long months at sea. Now she's home, on Liberty. She is the Liberty Woman, living free with Liberty Mini Hairspray. The Liberty Woman goes where she wants, and Liberty always goes with her, holding her hair softly, naturally.
Seem like anything happened.
Now we'll see what you were looking at. The spot shows your point of visual fixation. You were looking at the body of the model and not at the product.
Yeah, I like to bathe in soup.
Evidently, but that's exactly what we don't want. At $1 million a minute, we want you to be looking at what we're selling. Now here the computer is taking into account your specific responses and making you look at the product. It's
very precise, down to the millimeter.
Down to the millimeter? That's why you wanted plastic surgery.
Yes. We intended to create a group of actors with the exact specifications for visual impact. But it didn't work. This is Lisa before surgery, scoring 92.7. After surgery, she scores 99.4, which is the video scan registration limit. So she's perfect. But when she starts to move, her score drops back to 92.9. That was our problem. The girls couldn't maintain their scores. And they looked perfect, but they weren't really perfect. So we had to take another approach entirely.
While Long is showing him the various areas of DMI, Larry finds himself drawn to a lab designated Looker that has a strange light emanating from underneath its doorway. Long tells him that she doesn't have security access to that lab and continues on to show him how the full-body imager works, and that's when Larry palms a security key card from the desk of a technician, a theft that does not go unnoticed by Long, but she continues to show the surgeon around. Cindy and Larry end up finishing their business and depart as Long informs Reston of the card theft, getting his permission to send the Mustache Man, as played by Tim Rusevich, to search the good doctor's place, just to make sure he's not on to them. When they return to Larry's beach house, he is forced to come clean to Cindy as to why he's been spending so much time with her, as she learns from the afternoon news that Lisa, Tina, and Susan are all dead. Cindy begins to panic, wanting to get the police involved and yelling at Larry that he had no right to keep this information from her. Larry apologizes, and while Cindy has doubts about his ability to protect her, she ends up borrowing his car and going to visit her parents for a few hours, mentioning she's going to get some new clothes there and come back. While Larry is in the house, he ends up placing the key card in the corner of a framed photo, its background matching the car perfectly, hiding it in plain sight. As he puts music on and begins to fix himself a drink, he looks out his window, and that's when he experiences a flash. And he finds himself losing time and is confused that the people that were on the beach in front of his window have seemingly either moved or have disappeared altogether. And strangely, the music has been stopped. He sees another flash, and 2 hours have suddenly elapsed in what seemed to be a second. He turns on the TV and walks to splash water on his face, then he's flashed again. And yet another 2 hours has passed. And now it's evening, and Cindy has returned, horrified to see that Larry's house has been tossed, as if some unseen entity was searching for something. Yet they didn't find the hidden key card. Larry and Cindy head back to DMI that night, and Larry bluffs his way past security, posing as a scientist who wants to impress his beautiful date and show her the lab, and using the key card to gain access. As they make their way into the Looker lab, they learn it's actually a prototype light gun. It stands for Light Ocular Oriented Kinetic Emotive Response, Looker. When a person is exposed directly to the flash, they can be put into a trance and they can experience exactly what Larry felt earlier that day, a complete and utter loss of sense of time. Their snooping is observed by the Mustache Man, who attacks them with a Looker gun of his own, creating a rather lopsided beating where an entranced Larry finds himself seemingly thrown through glass windows and from room to room until he's finally able to pick up a pair of mirrored lab glasses and return fire with his own Looker pistol, immobilizing the corporate enforcer and fleeing the scene, escaping back to Larry's office. Reston is made aware of the break-in and sends his security team to murder the doctor and to kidnap Cindy. The two are eventually tracked down, and the surgical suite is flooded with smoke to keep Larry from being able to utilize his own Looker gun. Cindy is grabbed, and Larry is attacked with a machine gun, barely escaping with his life. His nighttime exit is short-lived because the Mustache Man and his team continue to give chase by way of car, with the doctor and the thugs engaging in a battle of Looker guns as they navigate the streets of Los Angeles in early morning traffic. Larry doesn't take into account that his rearview mirror reflects the light signal back at him, and suddenly finds himself crashed into a city fountain. He ends up running and hiding into what he believes is a police car, and he passes out in the backseat floorboard. He wakes up to find now that it's early evening, and as he sits up and gives himself over to the police, he realizes that they're actually Reston security forces, and these men are going to deliver him to his death. Roberts allows them to bring him into Reston Industries and then incapacitates them with his looker gun, stealing the officer's clothes and entering the gala that Reston is putting on. Lieutenant Masters, who's been following Roberts and knows he was attacked in his office, continues to trace him to the gala as well, shadowing the doctor but allowing him to continue his path to unwinding Reston's motives. Reston plans on showing the audience targeted television commercials infused with looker flashes, getting them to take in various commercials, everything from breakfast cereals to pointed political ads for a presidential hopeful, Senator Harrison, making him a more appealing candidate, and putting subliminal messaging in for the crowd.
Ladies and gentlemen, Senator Robert Harrison, candidate for President of the United States.
Hello, I'm Senator Harrison, sharing with you some of my private thoughts on the eve of the national election. Perhaps you feel as I do, that our great nation faces trying times, overwhelmed by inflation, swamped with bureaucracy, manipulated by faceless corporations with their expensive media campaigns. It truly seems a dark hour for liberty. But there is something we can do about it. We can return to the individual freedom and values of our pioneer forefathers who forged our country and made it great. A vote for me is a vote for the old American
tradition. They don't know what's being done to
against
them.
Against faceless corporations with their media manipulation.
They're fascinating.
Against
Look at
government
them.
Inflation bureaucracy. Against pollution of our environment and our lives. There is still time.
Larry is initially caught by the mustache man as he enters the gala, but he manages to escape him, taking an elevator up to the building's 19th floor, where Long is holding Cindy hostage and running the computer control panel for all of the CGI commercials. The mustache man and Reston himself grab silenced pistols and stalk Larry throughout the automated studio sets, crashing the very commercials they are beaming down to their guests. Jennifer Long ends up leaving the control station to attempt to help remove Larry from the set, only to have the mustache man shoot at her moving form, mortally wounding her. Long does manage to crawl back to the control booth, allowing Cindy to retrieve her handcuff keys and free herself. Larry is able to finally get the drop on the mustache man with the looker gun, and as he approaches the hulking menace, an overzealous Reston attempts to shoot the good doctor from behind, missing him by a few inches and instead dropping his key enforcer, whose body falls onto a table set and then is prominently featured in a breakfast commercial. As Reston goes to move in for the kill, Lieutenant Masters observes the armed man chasing the doctor across the commercial set and takes an elevator up to that level, intercepting the billionaire and shooting him in the throat before he can murder Larry. With the conspiracy now exposed and Larry officially cleared of any wrongdoing, the surgeon ends up turning to Cindy and informs her that he can no longer take care of her, because it's against the rules to date one of his patients. As they walk out of the gala together, credits roll. Jeez, where do we even begin? Here, let's do something a little different. Let's start with all of the good, because I do think there is quite a bit of it. In spite of the bizarre impracticality, props have to be given right off the bat for the looker light gun itself. That light, ocular, oriented, kinetic, emotive response gun, the likes of which makes a person lose time and question what they've just experienced or seen. Crichton would note that he based the gun on the sleek look of a cordless drill that he had seen back in the day, and yeah, it is kind of a strange thing to look at. But when you have a scene where you have a car chase shootout being carried out where both parties are trying to shoot at each other with said device while not looking at each other, it really does take on an interesting vibe. Where else are you going to see nuns angrily hit a car that stops fast for them? I, for one, enjoy the fact that Dr. Roberts' car seemingly ends up in the fountain without ever breaking the sides of the fountain, as if he jumped into it directly. But even with the use of the light gun, it's really kind of smart. When Reston sends his men to Robert's office to capture and kill Cindy, I really think it's a neat concept they took into account. They have to obscure the effects of the light gun, so they fill the office with smoke. It blunts the impact and it keeps the flash from actually having this disorienting effect. And as he's being stalked through his own clinic, you can really see the look of panic on Robert's face as he realizes this amazing tech is absolutely rendered worthless in his current predicament, and he's forced to improvise, quite literally bringing a knife, or in his medical case, a scalpel, to a gunfight. And hey, since I'm talking about Dr. Roberts, let's just jump into how fun it is to watch Albert Finney here. I really enjoy how balanced and, well, for lack of a better descriptor, normal Larry Roberts is. He's a nice person, he wants to help people, and he's rather disturbed when his former patients are being murdered. And while, yeah, he wants to clear his own name, his real first priority upon learning that Cindy is the next name on the list is just to keep her safe. Other than his skills as a surgeon, though, he's really not anything special. He's not particularly in shape, he's not a very good fighter, but he just wants to help. Think of him sort of as an everyman, or really, a very schlubby medical John McClane. And all that said, just because Finney has that charm of his, those eyes always seeming to be crinkling into a smile, you can't help but just watch the film and start rooting for Larry as he navigates this very, very muddled conspiracy. Honestly, if the man had any real superpower, it has to be being a complete gentleman in the face of having so many beautiful women offering themselves up to him. I, for one, really enjoy the scene where a drunken Cindy comes home with him for the evening, and the pinball machine that is her mind just starts flashing tilt when Larry sets her up in the guest room and promises to make her breakfast in the morning.
You will.
I can't. I'm working in the morning. Come on, I have a wine tropic in the morning. Don't do that. You're full of surprises. What next?
You get some sleep. Mm-hmm. The bathroom's over there. There's towel, soap, whatever you need. Coffee and eggs in the morning. I get up at 6:30.
6:30?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody gets up at 6:30.
Sleep well.
Where are you going? Larry?
It's subtle, but it's still funny. And clearly, there is still a lot of humor that Crichton at least got to keep in the film in spite of all the editing that the Ladd Company performed. For me, one of the most absurd and marvelously funny moments happens during that final chase sequence across the computer-generated commercial sets, where Tim Rossovich's mustache man is accidentally shot and his body lies prone on the kitchen set. His corpse suddenly shows up in the breakfast commercial, smack dab in the middle of the CGI family, having breakfast on and around his body, complaining about the food in front of them. It's so Monty Python in that moment. It makes you wish that more of the film was kind of like that. It's funny. And for those of you who appreciate cheesy, or at least more accurate period-style theme songs, I have to tell you, Looker offers up some fun pop ballads indicative of the films of the late 70s and early 80s, with Sue Sad and The Next performing the main theme, Looker, as well as the follow-up song on the end credits, Highwire. For folks of a certain age with nostalgic taste, this is undoubtedly a really fun jam to take in.
A pretty face reflected in the mirror, so perfect in every way. With every move, the picture's getting clearer. She's got it all, she's got it made. But when she smiles, is she really smiling? She's the only sad. She never shows. She's a
As a film, it's a rather subversive bit of subtext. It's commenting on our own culture's gullible fixation with beauty standards and the deceptive practices utilized by those in both corporate and political world to subliminally control the masses for money and power. This really shouldn't be a new concept to any of us here in the present of 2023, but back in 1981, this was some cutting-edge science fiction of the highest order. Seriously, computers that would scan an actor and actress into their memories so they can be used and keep their likeness forever, that was considered a very silly concept. The technology that was used and the psychology behind it in the day was not thought of appropriately as prescient. Rather, just deemed ridiculous. And here we are now, seeing it firsthand in the media that we regularly consume. But I have to say, I've danced around it long enough, I gotta get to the bad. Let me address the elephant in the room about how Looker so grossly misses the mark. It's the granddaddy of a plot hole that it offers up. The plot itself is that amalgam of half-thought-out conspiracy meets techno-thriller meets romantic comedy. Throw it together, fine, you can have cross-genres going on. But the one part that doesn't make a lick of sense, especially in light of the driving goal of our villains, if they want to subliminally manipulate the masses and ultimately use it as a way to control society's levers of power, then really, why are the good folks at Digital Matrix Incorporated killing off, and quite sloppily, I might add, the very models that they publicly hired to be their marketing tools? The film, as it was released in theaters, never gives us a logical answer. It just rolls on, taking other opportunities for satire, technobabble, and conspiracies, but never stopping to say, why are we doing this? Here's the kicker, though. Oddly enough, there's an actual answer to this dilemma. It's not a strong one, but at least it would have made a heck of a lot more sense if it was put into the film's theatrical release. In a deleted scene that was later reinserted to be part of the television cut of the movie, and would only show up later on future Blu-ray releases, when John Reston gets to have a Bond villain moment with Larry and Cindy after he captures them, he icily explains that they were viewed as part of corporate intellectual property, and he is just simply and ruthlessly enforcing company policy when it comes to the models.
Ah. So I am delighted to see you again. How have you been?
Keeping busy.
Good. And you, Cynthia?
Oh, I'm great.
I'm sorry about these surroundings, but we weren't expecting more company. Is there anything I can do to make you more comfortable?
How about a car to the airport?
The transportation will be taken care of later.
You use a looker device to put the girls in a trance, and then you kill them.
The surgical approach was a mistake. It always was clumsy. You see, the three dead girls and Cynthia here were walking examples of our computer research. They were the measurements, the database. And it's corporate policy to shred all old documents to keep it out of the hands of competition.
You don't need people anymore. You use computers to create perfect commercial images. You killed three people.
We're not just selling soap here, Doctor. The stakes are much higher than that. Think of all the trouble we're in today and what's behind it. Governments, politicians, not business. Multinationals want peace and stability throughout the world if the governments are recklessly out of control. Now somebody has to see that our future is secured.
I have a looker gun.
We'll get it back.
I gave it to the police.
You mean Lieutenant Masters? Yes, he's downstairs right now. He's a very ambitious young man, isn't he? Yes, the police are doing their job. They're putting the pieces together. You did surgery on three dead girls, and incriminating evidence links you to two of them. After the death of the fourth, I doubt very much whether your own suicide will cause much surprise, do you? Makes perfect sense when you think about it. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to get back to the next president of the United States. I hope you enjoy that wine. Goodbye.
Does the scene absolve all decisions made? No. It's still kinda silly, but the logic clearly given here beats no logic of the final theatrical cut by a country mile. And it serves to make both Reston seem a little more like a logical villain, who's not just killing folks for no good reason whatsoever. Plus, he's also admitting that his company has made a mistake that he's trying to fix, and they're going to blame Roberts for it to cover their tracks. It was Ladd who had this scene cut because he felt it interrupted the action and slowed down the plot. That is madness. In logical hindsight, though, why would DMI ever have to bump off any model, much less get them to go through multiple surgeries to render them each a uniquely perfect lady? If after scanning them into the computer system, it's deemed that Cindy's face is perfect, Lisa's body is ideal, and Jennifer has superior hair, couldn't DMI just take their programming and make the perfect amalgam of all of those women to create their ideal digital actress? And then you have all three of those desired traits together, and you can animate it and use that person as the model. There's no need to kill anyone. No need to pay anyone beyond that first scanning gig. And then, in theory, you have an actress that will work for DMI for nothing in perpetuity. Say, that would be a great plot they would uncover, right? And threaten to expose? And now they're being hunted to keep quiet? But no, we have to bring in all this weird subliminal stuff and government conspiracy, and the whole story itself just goes pear-shaped. Apparently, though, behind the scenes, there was even a lot more that was cut from this film that the studio wasn't wanting to acknowledge. You see, there's publicity stills out there that show Dr. Roberts interacting with a pair of ladies, and they get credits in the film. Pammy and Tammy, played by real-life sisters Lorna and Lila Christensen. They were actually meant to be comedic foils to Cindy's character, because they were going to be these two aspiring models that were repeatedly following around Dr. Roberts and Cindy and throwing themselves at him in an attempt to seduce him, hinting at the opportunity for a menage a trois if he would just see his way into making them equally perfect so that they would get hired by DMI. It was meant to be played up straight for comedy, as well as giving us a motive later, sort of in the end of the second act, that much-needed distraction which would allow Larry to escape from Reston. Ultimately, it was never included in any released version of the film. Instead, what we have is Candy, as played by 1977 Playboy playmate Ashley Cox, showing up as a random character at the gala who we've never seen in the film before, who seemingly knows Dr. Larry Roberts by name, and just unwittingly helps him escape the mustache man, purely by accident. Does it make sense? Hell no, but it's here. Why is this sort of thing happening? Well, it's just this marvelous combination of half-baked ideas running up against the Ladd Company's attempt to really make a strong product that could be enjoyed by multiple audiences at once. But when you put it all together, when you try to be all things to all people, all you get is a mess. James Coburn, who even in bad movies is still good, and he's amazing here, he's completely wasted. Because even though his scenes can be rough, and so much of his dialogue and presence is excised, he's commanding whenever he's on the screen. And Coburn, years later, was really salty about his experience on this film. He gave an interview in 1991 with Psychotronic magazine, where he stated, "My part was pretty much on the cutting room floor. They really pissed that film away. They had Albert Finney running around in a security guard's uniform throughout the film. It didn't make any sense. And it could have been a good picture. It was all about how television controls and how commercials can manipulate people to buy products, politicians, whatever. But they cut the film up for a television print, and I don't know why they did that. And even spent some real bread on that picture, too. It was $12 million production. That's not much today, but back then, that was a pretty big budget. So, we're talking about it. Let's do the movie math. You have a half-thought-out concept that you're adding with
remove scenes for TV versions, and you're adding to that completely unused footage, and you're adding a studio and a director who have completely different visions for the final product. And I'm sure you can see where this combination led. I hear you out there. Hey Chris, how was this film received? Well, based on everything I just said, not well. Upon making its debut on October 30th, 1981, Looker was panned by critics across the board. Leonard Maltin went out of his way to give it a rare bomb rating. Vincent Canby of the New York Times, with his usual fear of things modern, mocked it. He did sort of give it a backhanded compliment. He called it a slick-looking, paranoid nightmare about our society's increasing dependency on computers and the awful things that happen to us if the people who make computers join forces with those who decide what we see on television. He also noted, though, that the premise, though, is the only satisfying thing about Looker, noting that Crichton directed a film from his own stupefyingly nonsensical screenplay. Canby then continued with, "Mr. Crichton has fun sending up television commercials on one extended sequence, but his direction of the rest of the film is so sloppy, one suspects that if he himself were a plastic surgeon, two ears might wind up on the same side of the head." Pauline Kael was equally dismissive, noting that thinking about this movie could give you frostbite of the brain. And opened up its run on October 30th, 1981, and found itself competing directly against just a little movie called Halloween 2. Audiences voted with their feet, and in the end, Looker would barely make back $3 million. It would slink out of the theaters with its tail between its legs, would have some heavy rotation being played on HBO as a filler movie, before becoming a dusty sci-fi offering on the video store shelves. Honestly, I don't think the harshness towards this film has aged well here because, well, we're talking about all of this stuff right now. We do have AI technology replacing people on the big screen, providing their image and voice pretty much to do whatever is wanted. We're letting the things that we see, now made even more instantaneously via the internet and social media, manipulate us. No, the real problem with Looker is it just tries, again, to be everything to everybody all at once, and then it creates this disjointed feeling and a bunch of plot holes. Back in 1996, a mere 17 years after the fact, Crichton would comment during an interview for his novel Airframe that Looker was clearly too far ahead of its time. Only now are the issues of CGI starting to surface. He would again note that he felt he was ahead of his time in regards of media technology as he provided audio commentary on later releases of the film, stating that people found all of this to be really outrageous. Sometimes, I admit, I get into trouble because I have a feeling that I live in the future, but I know I don't actually. I just think things have already happened when they haven't happened yet. But they have happened as far as I'm concerned, or I think it's so self-evident that they're going to happen, I begin to behave as if they already have. So for better or worse, people aren't like that. Look, for my money, I think Looker is an interesting and fun little picture that is still worth seeing with folks, provided you give them some context, and you let them know, yeah, this movie's gonna have some problems, but when you look past those problems, there's some real gold to be found here. Clearly, in 1981, Michael Crichton was telling folks, hey, the future is now, and we're only now in the present beginning to actually comprehend that message. And that makes Looker a really interesting time capsule. The version of Looker screened here at the LSCE was the 2018 Warner Brothers Archive Collection Blu-ray release. The Blu-ray ports over the previous features that were available on the 2007 DVD release, includes a brief introduction from director-author Crichton, director's commentary track, and theatrical trailer, but It includes for the very first time the extended deleted scene from the network television version that gives us Coburn's Reston's chance to explain his motives and to patch up that darn Mack truck of a plot hole. For that feature alone, I view the archive release as being worth its weight in gold. And you can go on to Amazon today and get yourself a copy for a very reasonable cost of about $19.26. But if you're looking to be frugal and you care not about any deleted scenes, the 2007 version of the film was given a new snapcase makeover in 2015, and while it's not officially out of print, it can still be had from multiple sellers in Z shops, averaging about $14, which again is shockingly affordable. Now, just remember folks, we don't get anything here at the LSCE for telling you where to purchase your films at. We just feel in this day and age, it's ever so important to keep supporting physical media to ensure that these fine companies who own the rights to these amazing films will keep releasing the content that we all know and love. And at the end of the day, isn't that what it's about? Getting more of that content that you know and love? Besides, this is an authentically prescient film. Delivered in such a haphazard way, it's both a train wreck and a lark to take in at the same time. And again, touching on things that we are absolutely seeing right now. And man, if that doesn't move the needle for you, as a wiser man so crudely stated to me some 20-odd years ago, it's a Michael Crichton PG stroke fest of epic proportions with Albert Finney, Susan Day, and James Coburn. Get your coat. So what are you waiting for? Go out there and get yourself a copy of Looker today. So that's going to wrap things up here for this episode of I Saw It on Linden Street. Thank you so much for joining us. I'd like to again offer my profound apologies for the delay. Unfortunately, this year it seemed to have been the new normal, but we are planning on taking some new tacks to come up with in the calendar year of 2024 to both deliver content on a more reliable schedule, and that will sort of be doled out hopefully in early January, so please tune in then. If you like what we're doing here, that would be the LSCE Pooches and myself, please give us a favorable review on Apple Podcasts, hit that subscribe button, or hey, just do that wherever you're listening to us on. Did you leave us a fun review? Hell, I'll read it here and give you a shout out on the show. It's just my way of saying thank you for recognizing our love of cinema. Like this one from Shakarov1. Great deep dives into some cult classics and some just plain classics. I discovered this show recently while I was going on my own private Shocktober Film Fest, and I got back to one of my favorites, the 1988 The Blob. I did a search for the podcast that had covered it and stumbled on this one. Chris Roberts goes deep into background details, story summaries, and much more in this podcast. It's very slickly done, with lots of great sound bites, editing, and fascinating throughout, with a nice sense of humor that enhances but not get in the way of the subject matter. I've already listened to a few episodes, and I can see this is becoming a favorite. I hope it hasn't pod faded, but in any case, I have a lot of archived episode to catch up on. Highly recommend. First and foremost, Shakarov1, thank you. You said some amazingly nice things that are so very incredibly humbling. The struggle to be consistent with content as of late has been real, but again, we aim to please, and we ever so much appreciate the feedback. So, see folks, it's just that easy. You too can become a hero to us in short order. All that said, please swing by, check out our website, lscep.com, where we have articles, episode links, and comics for you to peruse. I'm very proud to say we're on Amazon Music, so if you have an account, simply say, "Hey Alexa, play I Saw It on Linden Street today." We're also featured on both Good Pods and Podchaser. Those are just a couple of podcast databases for listeners and creators alike. You can find us there, give us a follow and a review if you please, and hey, feel free to do that to any of the lists we're a part of to give us a little boost in the rankings. The more reviews and the increased likes, that affects those marvelous algorithms, and that makes us more searchable. And then we can share more of these films with more people. And we want to do that. And you want to do that, don't you? Of course you do! If you have any questions for us, any comments, any movies you want us to cover, any things you thought I got wrong, well, we want to hear from you. drop us a line, send us an email or an audio clip to lindenstreetcinemaexperience@gmail.com. Do you love social media? Well, we use it here. You can follow us, at least for the time being, on X, formerly known as Twitter, at LSCEP, or you can find us on Instagram at LSCE_podcast. If you'd like to be even more personable or wish to contribute a segment in the sidecar, send us an audio message by way of Spotify, a free and easy app to use. So until next time, please, everybody, take care out there, have a safe and happy holiday season, stay healthy and well, and remember, life's too short not to live in the past. Take it easy out there, everybody.
And now, folks, it's time to say goodnight. We sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment. Please drive home carefully and come back again soon. Good night.